Welcome again, and on we roll with Rake the Moon Episode 5. So, expulsion, the end of the line in the EFL Trophy, tends to be met with a shrug in most seasons, but there are much more muddled feelings about it when it's not down to on-pitch performance. Rake the Moon finds itself waiting for the written reasons again. We'll try and make sense of it as best we can, now the verdict has finally been reached. And our other staple so far has been the transfer window. Our aim is not to take you to Borland or drive you batty, as we look at the arrivals designed to drive Swindon to promotion. So hello Sam, we have a myriad of things to discuss, but there has to be room for the brief banter section, whether people want it or not. And because stupid and absurd things bring me joy, for some reason I have taken great pleasure in you marking each of the episodes Super Bowl style with Roman numerals. So what's brought this about?
I have no idea. I just started doing it and I think I'm going to stick with it. Although I'm going to get to a point where I'm not sure what to put. My knowledge of Roman numerals is only so-so. So if we're getting to large numbers of episodes, as I hope we do in time, then I'm going to have to consult some online tool to help me.
The other thing that made me wonder was this, you know how internet kind of memes and staples come. There was this time where suddenly everyone had to ask whether you thought a lot about the Roman Empire. So I was wondering if you've got some secret kind of intrigue in Caligula or Nero, for example, that has lured you down the Roman numeral route.
No, my Roman knowledge and interest extends only to Latin, to GCSE level.
And, we are two Latin GCSE scholars. Not that I can remember a word of it either.
Caecilius est in horto, I think.
Yes.
This is true, you know, salt of the earth football podcast content.
Right. Well, yes. Caecilius est in latrino was always very amusing. But there we are. That's what comes of being 12. Okay. I think we better crack on because we've got the grown up stuff to do. Right, so serious business, as we said. Swindon out of the EFL Trophy. The Football League has finally delivered its verdict. Expulsion and a fine as well to go on top of the FA, deciding Ollie Clark deserved another match ban and a small fine. So out they go at the quarterfinal stage, two games away from Wembley. I think the easiest thing to do is to divide this up, firstly, into the two sort of bones of discussion. But before we do that, I should say you have made your kind of long read on that, your kind of thoughts and analysis available free. So you do not have to subscribe to the Moonraker to get your view. So what's kind of prompted you putting this all into the public domain?
Yeah, well, obviously I want to respect the Moonraker members and they're obviously the reason why I'm able to do this job, which is great. But I think this is a subject that has had a lot of public conjecture, public debate, lots of differing opinions, lots of different angles feeding into those opinions. And I just wanted to place on the record for everybody to be able to consume perspective, having sort of been involved, well, not directly involved, but involved adjacent as this thing has gone through and spoken to various people who have knowledge of the situation or knowledge of the process that the case has been through. And I think that it's important that everybody takes on board all the different elements that have contributed to the story and that we make informed judgments ourselves based on the available evidence. And obviously not all the evidence is available at the moment. We have to wait for the written reasons to come out for us to learn a little bit more about mitigating factors and what the club argued and their position on everything. So yeah, there's lots still to come out, I think. But from my perspective here, I wanted everybody to be able to have one consolidated resource to try and inform themselves as much as possible, and I'm sure others will be doing so as well.
So head off to the Moonraker at the end of this podcast to get Sam's long read here. Let's start on perhaps the easier one, the team sheet issue, where Ryan Tafazoli was listed as a substitute instead of Aaron Drinan. This is done electronically now, it seems, by an iPad rather than the traditional business of writing it down and putting it onto carbon paper for coffees to be distributed all around. The club have kind of held their hand up and said, yes, we got it wrong. they've pointed out lots of kind of mitigating circumstances to how it couldn't be double checked, and the fact that the officials, when Drinan came out at the time, didn't manage to notice this either. And I'm tempted to put this into the kind of weird stuff sometimes happens category. I don't know if that's too generous or not.
I think I would agree with you on that. I think if this was isolated by itself, this would fit into that category alongside all of the other examples that have been quoted by fans and the media over the past few weeks, which several of those I mentioned in the article that's on the Moonraker this morning. And those all ended up in fines and not expulsion for their the relevant clubs there. And I think that that's probably a fair observation. It was a clerical error. It was an innocent error. I mean, you can obviously say that Drinan's involvement fundamentally did play a part in Swindon winning the game, but there wasn't a sporting advantage that was being sought from that. And also there is evidently some element of responsibility that has to be held by the officials on the day, particularly the fourth official who allowed Drinan to come on in the first place. If he wasn't listed in front of him, why he didn't object to that is as yet unknown. And I don't know whether we will get an EFL or a verdict from him, a statement from the match official in question relating to that one. Regardless, I just don't see that by itself as having been enough for expulsion. It's when you throw the Ollie Clark situation into the mix where realistically, once the FA make their verdict, I don't think there's any other way that this goes in an EFL hearing.
Yeah. It's hard to see how once it has been deemed that Swindon have fielded a player who is suspended and suspended in a high-profile case, if they don't kind of throw them out, then almost in a wider sense, perhaps anarchy ensues for the FA, much as we will no doubt spend more of our lives discussing the infamous portal. So I've seen sort of, you know, in some places people have been able to treat the words of the ban when in their head with absolute clarity, the period of 7 first team matches. Swindon's defence, it does appear, rests very much on this Football Association portal. I believe it is that where suspensions are listed and Clark wasn't on it. So I guess how do we feel these two different things stack up?
I think in terms of the portal case and the club's evidence, we only know what has loosely been stated in conversations with people at the club, either on the record in volatile or less than volatile interviews. And that's not a great deal, and it's not a lot of information from us to be able to go and examine. I think you're right that the fact that he was not listed as ineligible that day for that game played a significant part in the decision to play him. And that's probably why the club feel as aggrieved as they have done over recent weeks about the charges existing in the first place. But I think there's also a need to have some professional responsibility as well, and to accept that, presuming that what we're talking about is they checked the portal and it wasn't there, and that's the only bit that was done in terms of scrutiny on the situation, then can they say hand on heart that they did enough to protect themselves from this eventuality? And I think probably the argument at the moment is no, is that they didn't. However, we don't know what that additional evidence was that they have. Obviously, the FA's lawyers interviewed the club secretary. There was a full hearing with legal support engaged by Swindon as well. And a lot of the discussions that took place there have only been seen and heard by those involved directly at the moment. And that's why I hope we get full written, unredacted reasoning from the FA and subsequently from the EFL so that we can get a better understanding of what mitigating factors were taken into account by the FA, because evidently there must have been some mitigation, because the sanctions levied by the FA on Swindon were minimal. £1,000 fine is small for the situation. So that would suggest that there might be some element of shared responsibility. Equally, I think that Holloway had quite a good point amid his extraordinary interview with you, which I want to talk to you about as well in a bit, in that he was really angry about having his captain taken from him the day before a game at 5 o'clock in the evening. And I think that he had a, like, there is a point there, regardless of what Clark may or may have not have done earlier this season, regardless of the long ban that he spent, regardless of the fact that Swindon have not helped themselves in the way that they allowed him to play against Luton, there is still no need for the FA to send that ban at that time. There has to be a better way of doing it that allows for a football club to properly prepare for an independent, separate game of football. So I understand why he was angry in that instance. And obviously he is an emotional man and chooses often or cannot hide those emotions in circumstances like that. So I think that was a reasonable point, but we have to ask, in totality, did Swindon give themselves the best possible chance of avoiding any issue around this particular selection? And evidently they didn't. And ultimately they've suffered a consequence that initially might not be particularly costly, but obviously has the potential to have been, if that syntax makes any sense, to have been costly.
Yes.
Because they were two games from Wembley and a payday if they could win the trophy, and a day out for fans. So potentially costly as much from a morale perspective, from a PR perspective, and from a momentum perspective as from a financial perspective. That's a lot to get through at once. But yeah, I think that's the lesson that I would want to learn from this all is, can we engage in some honest introspection? Even if we feel wronged somewhat, can we have a look objectively, see what we've actually done, what we could have done better and do better, rather than engage, as I mentioned in this piece, in a sort of cycle of perpetual self-defeating practice where a mistake follows but with an apology, but then comes the same or similar mistake. And that's starting to become what the club is known as externally. And it's really important that changes. So lots of different strands come into this, Andrew, and I'm trying to wrap it all up so that we can talk about everything inside half an hour. But I reckon this is a subject that could be talked about for days and days on end.
Yeah, I think what I'm hoping to see in the written reasons, though, whether we will or not, is, as you say, what happened kind of after the portal said, okay, well, or the portal didn't have Clark listed, rather. I can envision, and this is strictly hypothetical musing, not with any basis in fact. You could almost imagine a club phoning up the FA and the FA going, well, it's not our job. It's not our job to tell you the rules. You're meant to. It is our job to tell you the rules, but it's your job to kind of figure out the rules, and we can't kind of give you guidance. So, I do wonder if that's plausible, if that makes sense, and in which case you are kind of left tossing a coin. Well, the ban looks like it's the ban, but the portal says it's not the ban. And do you want to go heads or tails, if you follow me?
Yeah, and I can, and that's why I can sort of understand a base level of irritation and annoyance from the club because of those inconsistencies. What I would like to know, and I don't know for sure, is whether there was a third step that was taken, whether they sought further clarification from a governing body or from any independent advisor that has knowledge of rules and regs, or whether it was simply the case of, well, the ban says he's not allowed to play, the charge letter says he's not allowed to play, but the portal doesn't, and we're going to go on balance with the portal. I'm not sure that I would want to make that call in a 50-50 situation, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
But we don't know until the written reasoning comes out. We don't know what the additional evidence was. Holloway might come and present that evidence to us at the pre-match press conference on Friday. I've no idea. I'm sure that he will want to engage on the subject. But until we know whether there was further action, all that is available in the public domain at the moment, to me, says that it was a bit of a bold step to make that selection based on what was available to them at the time. But again, we could see in due course that there was more. The FA evidently thought that there was a case to answer, even if there might have been mitigation. And as I said, once that decision was made, once those charges were found to have been proven by the FA last week, the AFL didn't really have much of a choice.
Yeah, no, I agree. As you say, if they don't expel Swindon once they're found to have fielded a clearly kind of ineligible player, you know, not one registered a second late or a minute late or whatever, then as I say, I think mayhem ensues. The other sort of slightly wider stuff that you've pointed out in your article, one is the general kind of level of off-pitch sort of staffing and support for this sort of thing. And perhaps we've touched on a little bit with our slightly indulgent media-obsessed hats, but that's what you get when you get two hacks talking to each other, about the kind of public representation that the club has outside an Ian Holloway press conference. Because, you know, the owner and chairman generally kind of keep them, sorry, the owner and chief executive, I should say, generally kind of keep themselves to themselves in the media business, as is their right. But it does, I would say, personally feel to me like their manager could do with a bit of support here rather than having to defend this on his own in his entirety.
Yeah, I agree. There's two points to what you bring up there, one being the sort of staffing levels in the administrative office, and one being Ian Holloway being left to front the entire thing pretty much himself in recent weeks. If we address the first, the point that I make here is that it wasn't that long ago that the head coach, in this case, initially Mark Kennedy and then Holloway for a very short period, had a head of football in Jamie Russell, club secretary in Jamie White, and a football operations manager in Bailey Coupland. And between them, that's three heads with rules and regs knowledge, and also, you know, three pairs of hands to be able to assist with this sort of stuff. Jamie Russell left October 24 to go to Salford. Jamie White left.
Or, sorry, I should say all the club decided to let him go, depending on which version of that you has been in the public domain. Sorry.
True, very true. Jamie White went in March of last year to join Eastleigh. And then Bailey Coupland left in June of last year to go to Burton Albion. Obviously, the club replaced Jamie with Alicia Henry. And Alicia has a background in rules and regs and has done similar jobs in the Football League. But there is no additional rules and regs knowledge within the building to support her on that, with the current structure that exists. From an administrative point of view, that is tricky for one person to deal with potentially multiple roles. And obviously she's taken on elements of different jobs that that Jamie White did. And having individuals do a lot of different things that previously you had more than one individual do things for might not be conducive to the highest quality output in certain situations. Now, it could be argued that this had nothing to do with this particular situation, but I'm hypothesizing about having maximum resource possible to support your administrative staff to allow you to have quality output and to do your job effectively, efficiently, and as well as you can. And we've all been in jobs, I'm sure, where we felt overworked and that we've had not enough resource, not enough manpower to assist with us. It's not unique to football. It's not unique to Swindon Town Football Club, but it still might just be something that plays into this situation that could be reasonably considered if an objective eye looked at it and thought, where could we do a bit better? So I think that is an area that's worth discussion. From the other side, and I've completely lost where we were with the other one, so you're going to have to guide me back to what the other point was on this.
I think it was the fact that, you know, essentially Ian Holloway, and sometimes in spectacularly flamboyant fashion, has been left as the public face and defender of the club's actions here, without much assistance from elsewhere.
Yeah, and I guess that sort of plays into this, doesn't it? But he's definitely being asked to do too many jobs, in my opinion. He is in charge of so much. He's responsible for the coaching, for the man management, for tactical decisions, for recruitment. And he also appears to be the only senior public face of the football club the vast majority of the time. And I don't think when it comes to situations such as this, when evidently he's such a passionate man that wants to engage on the footballing side, that it is fair to ask him to front up for everything related to the club. And it might not do him or the club any favours in the short, medium or long term to have to do that as well. So, yeah, I think that he has been left out on his own too much here. I think that the C-suite at Swindon has been very conspicuous by its loss of voice during this period. And that is another objectively reasonable point to look back on when the club examines their performance across this period, and to decide whether or not he could have been supported more from higher up, whether he could have been supported more with additional rules and regs, knowledge in the building, and not left to have to not only deal with a transfer window with games against three of the top four teams in the division, multiple Tuesday, Saturday, Tuesday, Saturday, Tuesday, Saturday, contract negotiations, tactics, planning for matches, deciding on itineraries, and also having to front the PR operation for everything. Sure, front the PR operation for what happens on the pitch on a match day, but let's have a bit of support. Let's give our manager some internal vocal support, and that hasn't happened here. And while he's evidently happy with the way that he's being backed in the transfer market and being backed to bring in the players that he needs to get this club promoted, I'm not sure that he has been supported as he could and should have been over the course of the past 4 weeks.
There's more we could do, but we will probably leave that there. We will be out with our fine-tooth combs, whatever they actually are, when the written reasons come out. So part two, the transfer window, is finally shut, closed, verboten, whatever. It's all done. Swindon have a lot more players than they did to start with. I wanted to start, though, as we kind of peer back at that, Sam, with the way Ian Holloway, almost with kind of the theatrical relish of someone removing a tablecloth and leaving all the cutlery intact, revealed that they had two bids from Aaron Drynan for Salford and that they turned them down with much glee.
Yeah, and we were trying to figure out, weren't we, on Monday, whether that was Salford actually wanting to sign Drynan or whether it was a bit of dark arts from them trying to unsettle a player towards the end of a transfer window. I mean, if it was either, they failed with both, so I guess it doesn't really matter. What is interesting to me is that Clement Fournier has turned down £750,000 now for two strikers across two bids this year, and that is the actions of somebody who genuinely is personally invested in getting a club promoted, at least, you know, on the field. That is some proper commitment to it. And you can understand why Ian Holloway gives so much vocal support to Morfuni when you consider things like that. So I think that's a really interesting subplot of the whole transfer window that was mighty madcap. It was, I think, half serene and half absolutely crazy. But that can happen sometimes, and I'm glad to be out of it. I don't know about you, but both windows are often quite trying from a news delivery perspective, but the winter one, when they cram everything into 4 weeks, is particularly exhausting, and it's quite nice to be able to, you know, talk about other things like being thrown out of football competitions.
Nice is one term, but yeah, before we dive back into the window, it does kind of, one of the things we were talking about in that last section almost kind of flips around in the reverse here, because I think we can say Ian Holloway is pretty much left to run the football side, and as a, you know, manager or and someone with all that experience, he rather, I'm sure he rather welcomes that compared to other owners who would have more desire to take an even closer interest in the transfer business. So let's look at the players they did bring in. We've talked about kind of Jake Batty here a little bit before, the left back to start with. So I'm not sure how much we need to dwell on him. But then the kind of two that sort of came late were James Scanlon and perhaps I don't know whether the deal sheet was part of this, the Junior Hoylett move very late on.
Yeah, and I mean they were both quite late in the window in general. I think these are things that sort of popped up over the last weekend. I think that they were both sort of agreed mid afternoon ish on Monday. So I'm not sure that a deal sheet would have been required for either. Certainly wouldn't have been required for Scanlon. He was done earlier in the day. They're interesting signings, particularly Hoylett. Although I'm not sure a lot of the fan base agreed with my use of the word fascinating to describe his imminent arrival on deadline day. I think that I find it fascinating because I'm not entirely sure where he fits into the team. He's come in wanting regular minutes to be able to prove himself for a Canada World Cup squad place, for a home World Cup. And that's a very honourable mission. And it is entirely likely that he probably will have had to have taken some sort of reduction in pay to be able to come down and do that. But how he gets those regular minutes, you know, starting regularly 60 plus minutes, is going to be fascinating, because where does he slot into this existing structure? He's not going to be played as a winger. Presumably he's going to be played as a 10. If he's played as a 10, can they realistically play their two senior strikers as well? And if they do that, then what was the point in bringing in some width and some pace? So I'm fascinated to see how it all bolts together and how he performs and whether he can be effective in sort of League Two conditions, playing pretty regularly, as Swindon have quite a lot of games in a short space of time. If it goes well, it's going to be a brilliant move for all parties. If it doesn't go well, we might think, was that all really necessary?
It sounds like at Hibs he has been playing more that number 10 role, which Swindon haven't really kind of deployed, other than when they did it to Ollie Palmer and they kind of really foxed Bromley with it for a good 45 minutes or so. So, you know, we might see some changes and readjustment. I mean, I guess they could play about wide, but it'll be a different Junior Hoylett, I guess, from the ones that we, you know, saw on the TV screens. The one thing I can seem to gather, whether it's from Neil Warnock tweeting or a bit of a chat I had with Sean Morrison, who's on co-commentary on Saturday, shameless plug, who was with him at Cardiff, is, you know, he seems a positive personality and one that is very happy to pass on his knowledge to younger players. So that's not the primary reason for signing him as well, but that might be a useful kind of factor in him arriving. And, you know, that knowledge of getting promotions over the line.
Yeah, Holloway's big on that sort of thing, isn't he? He often mentions about the pros who are influential in a dressing room and who can be relied upon at difficult times to improve moods or to put an arm around players. And I think he sort of mentioned how Tom Nicholls sort of brought that to the group last year. And I know that he was very fond of Kabongo Shimanga for the way in which he conducted himself off the pitch as well. So, yeah, I mean, these things are important. I'm sure it won't have cost Swindon an arm and a leg to bring him in for 6 months. I doubt there's much prospect of him signing on a longer term deal after this year. So it's going to be a short love affair. Let's see whether it's sweet as well.
Yeah, and so they eventually, after a look round, did go with Batty and decided to push that button on a external left back recruit.
Yeah, and that's been a player that has been on the lips of various people in the recruitment department for quite some time. I think that it's a player that was first pushed to Ian Holloway by Les Caffrey. It might even be over a year ago when his name was first mooted as someone who could be signed last summer. He's an interesting player, and again another example of someone who is getting himself a move for 6 months to try and put himself in a shop window. His contract was up at Blackburn at the end of the season. He knows that he wasn't going to get another one, so he's come out to get game time. He's probably another one who may well have had to take a pay reduction to make the switch in order to showcase himself. And we'll see whether it works. If Swindon are successful in the remainder of the season, it's probably because he's played a big part, and that might give him the opportunity to get a new deal at Swindon if they've been promoted. So all credit to him for putting himself out there. The move sort of makes sense. Yes, he's another relatively young guy, but he's been Accrington's player's young player of the year. He knows the level, and it seems a perfectly reasonable solution to a problem that was evidently there after Finlay Munro's departure.
And overall, the recruitment highlight apart for this window has been really kind of very youthful. Ola Kigbe has a certain amount of experience. You're looking at Fletcher Holman and at Aidan Borland, who don't really know their way around the level yet, much as Holman has settled in quite tidily. Do you feel that was necessary to, kind of counter the fact there are quite a lot of 30-somethings out there? How do you feel about that youth experience balance, I suppose?
Yeah, well, I think that he's taking punts with a couple. So Holman has obviously started really well and really fast. I think Ben Middlemass is one that the availability came up to sign a player, perhaps ahead of when other clubs would have been looking to sign him in the summer. And Swindon just tried to jump to the head of the queue by doing it. So perhaps less of a here's an immediate solution kind of signing, but more a one for the future, but we're going to play him now as well where we need to signing. But I mean, I don't know if he's just trying to bring the mean average of the group down, but he's definitely taking punts and backing his gut on what a player will be able to deliver for this group. What he's done is put a whole lot more attacking options into his squad, hasn't he? He wants game changers available to him, 3, 4, 5 game changers available to him at any given moment. And I think that the depth of the squad that he has had all season wasn't necessarily giving him a depth of sort of game-changing options. If you think about the contributions made by Prince Welhove-Batcherman, by Billy Bowden, and obviously with Danny Butterworth out injured for a long period, there has not been quite as effective options for him. And this was a case of him freshening those options up and allowing him to have more variety in those attacking positions. And now it's just a case of whether those players can fit into these systems and produce quality that makes that impact in the run-in. And if they do, Swindon will be in a very good place to challenge for automatic promotion.
We'll see if they can get it right, if Junior Hoylett's international clearance comes through, and if Prince Welhove-Batcherman is the solution to all of Salford's striking dreams between now and end of the season. I think we are fast approaching the time window. Sam, thank you. Remember, you can read more of Sam's feature on the whole EFL trophy saga. That will cost you nothing, and it may incentivise you to subscribe to the Moonraker on a regular basis. Goodbye for now.